sounds pretty simple, right? As you already know, it can be anything but simple, but check out this sweet-ass John Lennon quote. When I was 5 years old, my mother always told me that happiness was the key to life. When I went to school, they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wrote down, happy. They told me I didn't understand the assignment, and I told them they didn't understand life. When I first started auditioning in Los Angeles, I was depending upon the results of those auditions to make me happy. I quickly and efficaciously learned just how much that was a losing proposition. Even when things were going well, there just wasn't enough love involved to feed a body, which was understandable because it's simply an arena of commerce when you get right down to it. It's easy to become distracted by the beautiful people, the good times, and the swag, but ultimately, it's just a business. What it is most certainly not is a life. Another John Lennon jewel. Life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. This one really hit me in the breadbox. Recognizing the relative dissatisfaction that my other plans were bringing me, I immediately shifted my focus to filling in the rest of my life with whatever goodness I could muster, so that my momentary involvements in show business held much less sway. It took me a few years, but I managed to create a deliciously satisfying life, full of woodworking, theater, friends and family, but most importantly, the love of a good woman named Megan. I cannot stress enough what a positive effect this practice can have upon your auditions, and here's the greatest part. Even if the people at the auditions are assholes and you are totally rejected, the joke's on them because you no longer give a shit. This security lends an undeniable swagger to your auditions. Gone are the days of sweating bullets through your reading because the 1 week guest star paycheck hanging in the balance would hand you the life-saving 2 months of back rent you owe. The best part of step 7 is that even if for some reason you never get an acting job, you have tricked yourself, despite yourself, into enjoying and enduring happiness anyway. Pretty good trick. Now, let's wrap it up with a few thoughts for the people on the other side of the table, the suits at the networks. Now, I don't know if I can get through to you. I'm not even certain that you listen to books, or, I don't know, even if you have your assistants read them to you. Some of you are totally decent, sure. You tend to succeed, and you also tend to get along with your artists. A percentage of you have your heads in the right place. My beef is not with you. My umbrage is with the suits who feel the need to help the artists in the actual creation of the art. Here is my trip with you guys and gals. You and your company run a broadcasting business that is funded primarily by advertising dollars. The method by which you increase the amount of dollars coming in is to program content that engenders popularity, increasing the amount of viewership. The advertisers writing the checks to you naturally want as many people as possible watching their commercials, so if your television shows garner the most viewers, you will thereby reap the greatest amount of dollars. To that end, you try your darndest to hire writers, also known as creatives, who will bring you original gripping material so as to ensnare as many of those aforementioned viewers as possible. The brilliant men and women of whom I speak, these creatives, then fabricate entire worlds for you from whole cloth, peopled with characters of every flavor, for the embroidering of stories which will hopefully engage an audience for years to come. These writers are just about my favorite people in town. From the point of view of both a fan who is grateful for the heartwarming times they have provided me and my family and friends over the years, and an actor who directly benefits from the opportunities they perpetually create for those of my ilk to make a dollar doing work we can actually stomach. The creators envision the shows. They write the shows. They're going to shoot the shows. They make the shows. You, the suits, are, in effect, hiring a painter. You've seen their earlier paintings and greatly enjoyed them. You think that perhaps your company can sell their new paintings to America and the world beyond on your company's art channel. You run this art channel. You were a business major or a broadcasting major. You look at popular culture magazines and read newspapers and the internet tastemakers, and you evaluate charts of trends that are popping and hot. You then get in your BMW to drive over to the art studio to tell the painter that football, pulled pork, and small children in cute miniature vehicles are really happening right now. They're trending. Can the painter put some of those in his or her painting? And the painter will maybe try, because maybe the painter is contractually obligated to try, even though the painter was presumably competent enough to choose his or her own subject matter in the paintings that got him or her the job in the first place. But you don't leave it even at that. You then tell the painter what kind of canvas to use, and you stand with the painter as the painting begins, and you hand him or her brushes as you suggest changes to the picture's composition. The painter commences daubing on a cadmium orange mixed with a little primary magenta, and you say, "Hey, can we try blue, actually?" You have the temerity to tell this artist how to create his or her art, wholly forgetting an incredibly salient fact. You don't paint. I don't have to tell you. Network suits. How many millions of dollars are thrown away every year on failed pilots that are often embarrassingly terrible? All I am asking you to do here in Chapter 15B of my book is reduce your penchant for gambling by trusting your storytellers. The funny thing about the brilliant minds you have enlisted to create your paintings is that they have brilliant minds. If left to their own devices, they have the potential to paint you pictures in colors you'd never even have remotely imagined before they showed up. When you replace an actor who has been chosen by your show's creator with a different type of actor who has been chosen by a poll in Tiger Beat magazine or wherever teenage girls and boys now register their collective opinion, you are not thinking like a storyteller. You are thinking instead like a toothpaste company. You will not sell more toothpaste by adding flavor crystals or the phrase "now more minty" to your show. You will sell more toothpaste by allowing your show to be its own original animal, giving it its best chance to rise above the fray of mediocre dental hygiene programming, attracting hordes of toothpaste-consuming viewers. Then we might all have something to smile about. Chapter 16. Nowadays. Mom, I can't imagine anyone else has stuck with me this far, so I'll launch this final set of musings in your direction. And yes, I'll try to keep it light on the fudgin' sailor talk. My strangely fortunate life, as I now know it, really commenced with the advent of Parks and Recreation. But before I dive into that multicolored dream pool of magic pudding, not a euphemism, Mom, I want to describe an earlier event that has proved to be rather poignant for me. Megan and I had been living together in her West Hollywood duplex for a couple of years when we made a loose compact that we would get married at some point. We knew that we would be joined at the hip in any case going forward, but we thought it'd be nice to do the official secret handshake and whatnot, and also get our people together for a love party. We had also been talking about buying a house, moving on up, as it were, in the parlance of the Jeffersons. After some shopping around, we found an incredible house in the hills above West Hollywood, right next to Blue Jay Way, a street made legendary in a song by this cool band, The Beatles. Mom, I told you about them, remember? You like their cover of Till There Was You from The Music Man. We moved in, and it would never fail to amuse me that I was coming home to this house. A home that Megan had created and designed so that it felt like a welcoming and cozy work of art. I'd pull into the garage, covered in sawdust more often than not, and just have to giggle as I stepped into the front hallway to be greeted by three enthusiastic poodles. Into this new life as a guy who lives in the finest abode. Soon after we got settled in the new house in 2003, which included a lovely little pool in the yard, I was dumbstruck one day to realize that I had made it. Thanks to Megan, I was a well-off dude living in the Hollywood Hills like a king. My whole life, since high school anyway, I'd had a fantasy image of what life would be like if I ever was successful enough to have a house with a pool. The dream was simple. I would smoke some weed and listen to Neil Young and float in the pool. It had snuck up on me so sweetly that I was completely flabbergasted to realize that I had all of the necessary ingredients to make that noble dream a reality. Without dawdling, I smoked some fine California herb and put Neil Young's Russ Never Sleeps on in the house, and then casually flipped the switch to pipe it through our outdoor speakers. Living the fucking dream, people. Sorry, Mom. I made a cool drink and took my leisure like a gall-danged king, reclining on a floaty raft in the pool under the brilliant Southern California sun. It was rich. I mean to tell you, it was delicious. It lasted all of two songs. Apparently, I was an old dog by then, a robust 33 years old, because I was not about to learn any new tricks. As I floated in the pool, blissfully reclining to Neil's admonition that it's better to burn out than to fade away, I grew restless rather quickly. I took a step back and examined my prone form bobbing upon the sparkling blue water. What am I, an asshole? What am I gonna do, buy a yacht and just be some rich asshole floating on my yacht? Jesus, man, look at yourself. The sun is up. You should be getting something done. What I had learned was that I don't achieve my happiness by taking it easy, but instead by using my time and abilities to be productive. I mainly focus my productivity in the arenas of performance and woodworking, but I also prefer to be spending time with Megan and our dogs, my friends and their kids, and my family whenever I can get to them. I am thankful that I had the opportunity to learn this for myself firsthand, or otherwise I might have spent my life wishing foolishly for that stoned pool time. That day in the pool taught me that I still just want to make things with my time, but being more financially successful simply meant that I might make things whilst sporting a nicer pair of socks. Whether they're from Sears or L.L. Bean, I still want to get them dirty. Or else what am I, a goddamn layabout? A man of leisure? Fuck that. Sorry again, Mom. Until these hands give out, I believe there's work to do. When Parks and Recreation looked like it might stick around for a little while, I was faced with a choice. Close up my wood shop and lock the doors, letting it sit dark and silent until my time freed up again, or find some help to keep that beautifully shitty old warehouse cranking out sawdust and shavings. My whole life had been spent actively participating in the healthy lives of productive communities, starting with my huge family in Minooka, followed by my theater families in college in Chicago, as well as the Evidence Room family and my circle of fellow artists in Los Angeles. It only made sense that I would now create my own sphere of support at Offerman Woodshop. With my usual bounty of dumb luck, my friend Sam Moyer, an excellent fellow woodworker, introduced me to a small lady from Berkeley who had helped him install a kitchen. According to Sam, she had outworked the three strong men she accompanied that day. This was hard to believe when I met Lee, since she is about as tiny as my bride. Welp, I've been wrong before, and the smart money's on my being wrong again. Lee regularly outhoists me, and I'm not a weakling by any stretch. Beyond her brute strength, far beyond, she comes ready-made to administrate a shop with an almost eerie specificity. A lifelong woodworker, she's worked for years at San Francisco's Exploratorium, an extremely progressive think-tank laboratory of a museum that has been scientifically challenging and educating its visitors for more than 40 years. As if museum-level meticulousness wasn't enough, she then took some further learning from the venerable College of the Redwoods in Fort Bragg, California, in a woodworking program created by famed furniture master James Krenov. And she's strong as a mule, also known as two Offerman boys. Lee has become so valuable to me that I would gladly exchange my right hand before losing her, and bear in mind, that's my burger-flipping hand. I immediately made her my new shop manager, and together we have collected a charming fellowship of elves that is ever-shifting and always learning. A wonderful aspect of having a few heads in the shop at any given time is the different perspectives we all can bring to problem-solving. I look forward to all of my fellow OWS craftspeople surpassing me in experience so that I may begin to dodder in my age and lean upon their superior know-how. Any minute now. I greatly admire these peers of mine for the courageous choice of devoting their lives to making exceptional pieces in wood, even though it's terribly difficult to eke out a living as a craftsperson. This is a shameful state of affairs, but it is all too real in our modern consumerist economy. At Offerman Woodshop, we are doing our best to help foster the rebirth of handcrafted goods into the mainstream of middle-class furnishings, but there is a long way to go. We make everything by hand, meaning we will never employ computer-driven fabricating tools such as a CNC router or a 3D printer. Furniture by robot is the opposite of what we're after. Factory furniture is only better in that it makes the manufacturer more profit for cheaper prices, but you get what you pay for. In every other way, our products are vastly superior, made one at a time with love and skill. I'm proud to be a part of this movement of noble handcrafting, which I believe will strengthen our society immeasurably. Or at least to the point where we're not dependent upon foreign manufacturing to make our furniture and clothing and many other items, all of a quality that renders them disposable. When we make you a table at Offerman Woodshop, we intend for your family to enjoy it for a couple of hundred years at least. Now compare the prices again with that in mind. While the elves are having all the fun with the shed full of tools over at Offerman Woodshop, I'm toiling away at my pesky dream job at Parks and Recreation, a job that feels like toil about as much as a muskrat feels like a jellyfish. What can I say about this playground which Mike Schur and Greg Daniels have built, where I can be rewarded with money and food for the hardship of watching Amy Poehler and Aubrey Plaza stare each other down like two beautiful gladiators in a battle of mighty comedy wills? Each and every cast member makes me laugh with an unadulterated delight. Amy, Adam, Rashida, Aziz, Aubrey, Rob Lowe, Retta, and Chris Pratt. Every single one. There is no one else associated with the cast who merits my admiration. I could never leave any of them out. Jim O'Hare, who plays Jerry, is also a member of the cast. Pratt is my special favorite, which I believe is also the case for most of, well, the human population. His hijinks, more than any others, leave me peeing in my britches with consistency. It's all completely stupid, by the way. The beauty of our jobs is that we're allowed to behave in a juvenile manner of an ilk that the rest of polite society has been forced to eschew because of a development called maturity. To wit, one day we were shooting the episode Two Parties, and all the boys were at the freaky aroma bar called Essence, where every cocktail comes in some crazy form, like a mist or a lotion or a flash of light. Pratt's character, Andy Dwyer, received a beer that he ordered, which was inexplicably in the form of a sphere of cotton candy. Pratt proceeded to sculpt a vagina in his cotton candy, which, it must be noted, is not the easiest medium for sculpture. It was very masterful, by the way. He's a talented visual artist with an apparently intimate knowledge of the female genitalia. He then proceeded to subtly display his cotton candy vagina to the rest of us, nibbling and licking it for our edification as we all tried to maintain a straight face, because we were on camera performing our scenes. By the end of the take, he had eaten the entire sphere, maybe a ball with an 8-inch diameter. That's a fair amount of sugar to put in a lad, even a large boy like Christopher. Well, you get along to the 6th or 7th take, and you realize that there have been 6 or 7 more balls of cotton candy with subsequent vaginas, all dutifully consumed by Mr. Pratt. Now it's go time. When he gets sugared up, he completely becomes a 5-year-old, in terms of hyperactivity and volume and hilarity, which has not escaped the notice of our producers. I have not had this confirmed, but I believe every 3rd or 4th script finds Andy Dwyer in close proximity with some form of candy or cake or other sugar-based item. Pancakes with syrup, a bowl of Skittles, several racks of pork ribs slathered in sweet barbecue sauce, you name it. Seems like something more than coincidence to this investigator. Whatever the provenance, nobody's complaining, because Candy Pratt is better than any cartoon, and I've seen the Ren and Stimpy show and the Big Snit. So the day was really fun and long, which just translates as more hours of fun, until we finally finished up the shooting at an ice cream parlor, again with all the boys, bachelor party style. Everyone got to order his ice cream of choice, which didn't really suck as far as things you have to do at work, but here's a bonus tip for aspiring actors. Whenever you get to enjoy an indulgence in a filmed medium, just remember that you might have to enjoy that treat as many as 20 times in a row. Once per take. I can't tell you how many times I've made myself green in the face by deciding to smoke heavily throughout a scene, only to be ready to go gills up by the 4th take. You want to take it easy. With that in mind, I asked for 1 little scoop of butter pecan in a sugar cone. My plan was to eat just the small scoop of ice cream and none of the cone, so I'd end up with a nice dessert of maybe 6 small scoops of ice cream. Rob Lowe and Adam Scott, sagacious veterans, chose to just barely nibble at theirs so they wouldn't be forced to overeat if the scene ran long. They chose wisely, as it turned out, as we ended up moving the camera a couple of times with 6 or so takes per camera position. So your author ended up eating 21 small scoops of ice cream. I was pretty happy, honestly, with about the first 14 scoops or so, but then they began to hurt. The price of showbiz. If I was feeling beyond bloated, I can't imagine what discomfort Pratt was enduring, having chosen a large scoop of strawberry in a waffle cone, 1 per take. His 7th or 8th sugar buzz of the day kicked into high gear, which made the literally creamy vaginas he was now sculpting into his strawberry treat even more hilarious. Bear in mind that an ice cream cone involves tongue work rather than sculpting by hand, which was the case with the cotton candy. I thought I was going to need hospitalization. He was making me giggle cry so deep and long. And it is for performing activities like this that I receive a healthy salary. How could I ever lose sight of what a lucky son of a bitch I am? This acting job has literally put more bacon in my belly than any butcher shop. It has caused more Lagavulin whiskey to course through my veins than any well-stocked public house. I miss my time at the shop, but my role of Ron Swanson only requires my presence on an average of 3 days a week, which leaves me 2 days at the shop. We even shot an episode at my goddamn shop, titled The Possum, in case you're curious. At the time of this recording, we have completed 90 glorious episodes and are gearing up to produce another 22 this coming season, which will be called Season 6. I have met a lot of great writers in my day, but I could never have dreamed that I would run into writers like Mike Schur and his gang of smarty pantses. If you like Ron Swanson, then imagine how I must feel when I open a new script and see lines of dialogue like, "When I eat, it is the food that is scared." It's like Christmas every week, if your folks got you a present every week that was better than your fondest wish. How an ignorant kid from Manuka who likes to crack wise could end up with such an unbelievable bounty of good luck is certainly beyond me. I do my best to keep my karma in check by working hard and minding my manners. It's easy to do when I see so many, about 130, give or take, people on our crew, busting their humps around me every day, without the pleasurable benefits of delivering delectable jokes like mine, nor being fed bacon and steak at every turn. By now, I am well satisfied with the experiences I have been afforded as an actor. If folks continue to let me befoul the air of their theaters and film sets from here on out, I'll be quite grateful, but at some point I imagine they'll have had their fill of my particular brand of wolf bait. When that happens, I'll simply be afforded more time in my woodshop, a situation that I believe is referred to as win-win. On top of that, I recently discovered a new sideline in which I might be allowed to continue cutting my cheese, that of humorist. Never in a Google years did I dream that I would perform for audience as myself. Not to mention playing the guitar and singing without irony. But when a couple of American universities invited me to come entertain their students, I decided to take a crack at it. They let me finish all of my material, which I take as a high compliment, and by now I've performed at dozens of colleges and also beautiful theaters and even some crappy theaters all over the country. It's a great deal of fun, and I don't have to memorize any lines, plus I don't have to build any scenery. In truth, this book only came about because of my first humorist show, American Ham, which, when witnessed by some people in my corner, caused them to tell me, "That show sounds like your book." So I thought, alrighty then. One of the greatest aspects of touring as a humorist has been the opportunity to experience fans in a way I never had before. For example, at Iowa State University, there was a healthy contingent of tailgating in the parking lot before my show. Several grills were busily engaged in the creation of Ron Swanson-themed meat items. What was this? Despite my need to prepare for the show, Mom, I couldn't help but follow my nose in a meandering search that led to the clutches of students happily shoving bacon and turkey legs and steaks and burgers, not to mention noble beers and estimable Scotch whiskies, into their beautiful pie holes. It was a privilege to shake their hands and an even greater honor to be handed a jalapeno cheddar bacon cheeseburger, with which I handily stuffed my own gob. I told them that this must be the most charismatic fan interaction ever, in which they were providing me with the fuel which I would then shortly burn in the entertaining of them. Mother, as you know, when I first met Megan working on the Berlin Circle at the evidence room, one of her numerous top-drawer selling points came quickly to light, her singing voice. Bitch got pipes, as I believe the kids are saying these days in their hipster parlance. Early in our acquaintance, I asked her what her singing was like, and she quietly sang In the Gloaming into my ear with a bit of whispered tremolo that delivered but the first of Cupid's many darts to my ursine heart. I came to understand that she sang in many different flavors and styles and mediums, from rock clubs to Broadway, and I fell head over heels for her voice just as I was becoming soundly smitten with the rest of her. She has a few records available with her band Supreme Music Program, which make for truly beautiful listens, upon which she favors story songs, or ditties with a bit of narrative, in other words. Tom Waits, Bobby Gentry, Patty Griffin, Randy Newman, John Prine, Brecht Vile, Dolly Parton, George Jones, and Jack White are just a sampling of the artists whose songs she covers with her reimagined dramatic renderings of each number. It is, simply put, damn good shit. Mom, sorry, I give up. In 2011, Megan and I were in Austin, Texas, shooting a film called Somebody Up There Likes Me with our friend writer-director Bob Byington. Bob had cast a local Austin actor who had garnered some notoriety for her work in the superlative television series Friday Night Lights, by the name of Stephanie Hunt, as one of the alluring young ladies in our film. Inadvertently, Megan and Stephanie found themselves in a car one afternoon, and Megan asked her to sing one of her ukulele songs that we had heard about. Stephanie replied that she would oblige, but only if Megan joined her in the chorus. So they sang a song in close harmony, and they immediately sounded so good together that the PT Cruiser in which they sat turned itself into a GMC Yukon. These ladies could sing. Thus was a new legendary force of female entertainment born, the duo that calls themselves Nancy and Beth. These two ladies sing close harmony and perform choreography by Megan with such elan and goddamn pizzazz that it's all the audience can do to keep their seats. So toe-tapping and finger-popping is the nature of the noise they make. You've seen them, Mom, you know. At some point, our two forces combined, a la So Much Chocolate and Peanut Butter, so that we began to perform tour dates together. I crack wise and play my silly songs, then they floor the audience with talent and an overabundance of feminine kapow, and then we do some songs together. Between these joint shows and our work together on stage, on TV, and in film, Megan and I have come to feel like an old-fashioned showbiz couple, an almost vaudevillian comedy team, which really knocks me flat. Singing in her vicinity feels like showing off my backhand to Venus and Serena Williams, but I give it the old college try nonetheless. Our mutual affection is surely on display, and that brings some production value with it, upon which I can lean when necessary. Performing in this way has been one of the most unexpected pleasures of my recent years, and it's a gig I hope I can hang on to for a long time to come. As you can see, my dear mother, all things considered, my only gripe these days is wishing for more hours in the day. I've figured out and lucked into how to have so much fun at work that it has become my main vice. After spending years trying to find opportunities to perform for more and more people in my own style, I have now stumbled upon a moment where I can fill up a calendar year with such employ. Knowing all too well the fleeting nature of my business, my inclination is to strike whilst this here iron is a-heated, but too much of that will cause me to neglect the balance in my life. Therefore, while continuing to entertain folks when I can, I also do my best to see my family and friends and also just to spend some time doing nothing, lounging about with my wife and dogs, making sure we don't burn the candle too virulently at both ends. It's a challenge sometimes, being faced with too many tempting opportunities, which is what we call in our house a champagne problem. More often than not, I have found beer to be an effective solution. But I guess Dad already let you know about that, didn't he, Mom? Go outside. I'm assuming my mom thought the last chapter was the end, so now that she's gone to bed, let's fire up the real final chapter, motherfuckers. Pack that shit up full and give me a match. Some cool weed talk for you there. In case I haven't gotten it across to you by this point, here's my trip. I'm opposed to a lot of the time that we as a civilization have come to spend looking at screens. For my money, life is much more delicious damn near every place but inside that screen. Take film. I go see films that I think I'll like, starring and shot and written by women and men toward whose work I am favorably inclined. I don't see a lot of films. Taking in a film with Megan on a date is a delectable treat, and then I don't care as much what's on the screen, but still. Take TV. I don't regularly watch TV as an activity. I find a show I like, be it Deadwood, The Wire, Bob's Burgers, or Breaking Bad, and I watch the shit out of it, on my own schedule, which is a luxury afforded us by modern technology and broadcast systems. My favorite method by which to consume a series is by acquiring said program in its entirety and watching it on a vacation binge with Megan. Hole up in a hotel someplace with a view of the ocean or the forest or the desert and indulge. Drink deep and long and then have done with it. Take the internet. Is it an insanely amazing information system? Duh. It's the insanely amazingest, easily. The world in which we now exist, especially within our minds, has been so irrevocably altered by our collective ability to access virtually any information in existence with a few well-chosen keystrokes. The World Wide Web is a resource that I use with some regularity to answer questions. When working on a canoe, for example, I regularly visit the Builders Forum that Glenn Smith runs at the Bear Mountain Boats website, where all of my questions tend to find an answer or three. The various conversations in that chat shed are fascinating to me, and if I'm not careful, I'll catch myself reading correspondence well beyond the information I sought in the first place. So believe me, I understand how fiendishly the internet can tempt a body to indulge in diversion from one's responsibilities, more commonly known as iniquity. Idle hands are never the devil's workshop more than when those recumbent mitts are resting upon a computer keyboard. And that's just the internet. I do reluctantly use Twitter to communicate information to the folks who seem interested about humorist tour dates and film screenings and new releases from Offerman Woodshop, because it's an incredibly effective way to reach an audience directly. That doesn't seem particularly foolish to me. I even add some occasional ribaldry and eye candy to my dispatches to keep the flypaper a little sticky, if you will. Yes, I am comparing my fans to flies, but only in the most poetic of fashions. In truth, I imagine they are, for the most part, jackasses, as are we all, to a similar or slightly lesser extent than myself. I digress. What I am driving toward, with all due haste, is the simple comforting message that spending time outside in nature, to my way of thinking, is a much more gratifying diversion than anything one can engage in upon a screen. "Hang on, guy," you interrupt. "Don't you make your living through people looking at screens?" Yes, adroit listener, indeed I do, nicely observed, and I sincerely hope that each and every one of you watches and enjoys Parks and Recreation and Children's Hospital and my films as well. I know that not all of you will see it all, and if you do, not all of you will enjoy all of the content because people simply have differing tastes. How else do you explain feta cheese? Ugh. In any case, I only work on material that I think is well worth people's time and that I would be proud to display upon my resume. So, I'm not suggesting that you never watch filmed entertainment. No, far from it, in fact. I'm suggesting that you only watch programs containing my wife or myself. Have a good laugh on us, perhaps rewind a few of your favorite moments, and then get your ass outside. When I am at my family home in Illinois, we love to visit the old towpath along the Illinois and Michigan Canal. It's as picturesque there as any postcard, brimming with wildlife and all the local flora that we find so charismatic. There are other gorgeously appointed state parks we love to frequent, champing through the woods, exclaiming our pleasure at nature's grottos with all the gusto of Theodore Roosevelt. We also love to vacation in Minnesota, as I've mentioned, where our main activity is to float ourselves out upon a lake in a boat or pontoon, fishing, sure, but really the fishing is just an excuse to sit on blue water in the middle of verdant green forest, packed with both deciduous trees and conifers, beneath Mother Nature's gorgeous and vast sky, often quilted with cumulonimbus confections. My folks and my siblings and I have always loved to ramble about any part of the planet on foot, but we seem especially drawn to scenery that juxtaposes water with the woods. I believe that makes us Midwesterners. It seems worth mentioning that we are a pretty mellow bunch who don't seem too affected by stress, and I can't help but see at least a slight cause and effect happening here. Many people react adversely when I suggest a venturing into nature of any sort, sometimes stating without shame that they don't want to get dirty. I tend to stare silently for a moment in response, containing my disappointment, before calmly explaining to them that getting dirty is the whole point. If you're getting dirty, that means that you have traveled to where there is no pavement. When you sojourn into such terrain, you greatly up your chances of experiencing some full-on wild nature. I reckon it's not for everybody, but everybody is not penning this tome about fundamentally delicious living. I am. I am personally opposed to the recent development that positions young parents so violently apposite to germs and dirt in general. I have enjoyed a life of terrific health, knock wood, while remaining generally filthy most of the time. Every time I have the opportunity to eat some food that has fallen on the ground, especially in an airport bathroom, I jump to it, in the firm knowledge that I am solidly fortifying my immune system. The cleaner we keep our children, the weaker they will become. One man's opinion. Also, most bugs are pretty tasty. Finding yourself a spot by a creek or under a tree or atop a butte or along the shore where you can sit and look and not think brings a peace that not even the most mellow of Enya tunes can achieve. Enya made some records in the 80s and 90s that were super cool and mellow, you guys, and she's still at it. Anyway, seeing sunlight dapple the leaves of a tree whilst a breeze plays across those same leaves, weaving endless permutations of imagery and soothing sound, is gonna do you some good, is all I'm saying. When I spent some beautiful days in the mountains of Japan, I was quite taken with the philosophy of the Shinto discipline. In short, it is a form of spirituality that links the indigenous people to their past generations, as well as nature. Hiking in those mountains, we came upon exceptional examples of nature's beauty, such as an ancient oak tree or a waterfall, which would have been distinguished by the Shinto priest with a white ribbon, to communicate the exceptional power of the spirit in this special object or place. I felt much more akin to that expression of sacred than I have ever felt to the trappings of a Western church. If you incorporate hiking or cycling into your robust chill trip, so much the better. Clockin' yo cardio and peepin' dopiaries is how some of the modern skateboard enthusiast kids might describe this practice. Dopiaries are, of course, dope-ass topiary bushes. Obviously, topiary work requires landscaping, which indicates civilization, so we would tell those deaf street sprouts to head a little deeper into the wild. Now let's kick that shit up a notch. Get yourself a kayak or canoe. I don't even care if you don't craft it by hand out of wood. I don't. You should at least make your own paddle, though. That's not asking too much. Now, get out on the water and view all of the same exquisite scenery from a silently gliding watercraft. One mighty advantage to the small boat is your stealth factor. Whilst cruising downstream in small California rivers or cutting a swath across a Minnesota lake, I have happened upon critters quietly drinking at the banks with great frequency. If you think that a doe and a couple of fawns standing a few yards away watching you float by, or a beaver swimming along with a willow branch for its front porch, won't chill you out and heal the hole that getting too many emails is eating in your brain's ozone layer, then your thinking parts might be in need of repair. Can't lay hands on a boat? Get an inner tube. Use your noggin. String together some shipping pallets and float them on 4 or 5 gallon water cooler bottles. Set a couple of lawn chairs on top, I might screw them down, and take a leisurely and restorative voyage upon the king's barge. Besides the enjoyment in getting one's britches both wet and dirty, such marine trips are incredibly inexpensive to produce. If you're dealing with moving water and you're not a complete ignoramus, you can have a rather perfect afternoon for the price of those Guinnesses in the cooler. Finally, the most delicious combination I have found in life is created by bringing your romantic love into your rustic constitutionals. Experiencing all of the naturally exquisite features described above hand in hand with your beloved cannot be topped. Except maybe by encountering the same setting while 69ing each other. That might just be the most truly delicious living. Megan and I love to hike in all terrains, sometimes with the dogs, sometimes with a bottle of wine, and yes, sometimes mouthing each other's genitalia. We have a regular excursion in Northern California that culminates in a breathtaking stretch of coastline, where we powerfully savor the view, the elements, and the company. At the end of the tale, I can't imagine you'd ever wonder why they call me the lucky bastard. Paddle your own canoe. Siddhartha said, "Life is like a river. The thought of watching it pass me by causes me to shiver. So I grab life by the balls. I got some advice to deliver. Get off your caboose. Paddle your own canoe." Young Teddy Roosevelt was a weak little puss. But he exercised and became quite an ornery cuss, till he could whoop 2 bears and also Cuba without a fuss. By God, number 26 paddled his own canoe. You like to smoke some reefer and you like to dance. The preacher tells you to keep your pecker in your pants. But the preacher'd be kissing your nephew, given half the chance. He can go to hell. Then you can spend your Sundays paddling your own canoe. I might have mentioned Jesus Christ himself got high in my van. I told him I wouldn't go to church, and he shook my hand. He said, "My son, just let me run inside and use the can, number 2. Then let's get some Doritos and paddle your sweet canoe." What would Jesus do? Paddle my goddamn canoe. Take the road less traveled, says Robert Frost. Keep your stone rolling so it don't accumulate no moss. Leave the faint of heart sucking on your exhaust. Live a little life and paddle your own canoe. Don't while it away, master baitin' in the ditches. Put your tackle away and hitch up your britches. Then provision your boat with several pulled pork sandwiches. Indulge in savory meat stuffs. Paddle your own canoe. This is Nick Offerman. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Paddle Your Own Canoe. This program was executive produced by Patty Perus and produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Paddle Your Own Canoe is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, copyright 2013, all rights reserved. The book, Paddle Your Own Canoe, is available wherever Dutton books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.